The first question that we'd like to start with is the question of your role with the World Heritage Convention. How have you been involved with World Heritage?
First of all, I got involved as early as 1983 when I became the director of a World Heritage Site. At that time, it was not even a World Heritage Site, I must say. But it had the potential of becoming a World Heritage Site. And then in 1986, Greater Zimbabwe, where I became the director of the Greater Zimbabwe, was proclaimed a World Heritage Site. But the interesting thing at that time is that we didn't even know what this involved, because 1980 is when Zimbabwe became independent. And then UNESCO got us involved. They were very interested in this site. It's a historic site. It used to be the center of a major empire that controlled the present Zimbabwe, western Mozambique, and eastern Botswana, and northern present South Africa. So it was a major empire. You know, it was really an initiative driven by UNESCO, and I still remember when I effectively took control of Greater Zimbabwe. I was not even aware of the significance of what this convention was all about, let alone seeing a copy of the convention itself. It never occurred to me, and it was to be until 1995 that we became aware of what World Heritage Convention means. And this is when, after the launching of the Global Strategy of 1994, efforts were now made by ICOMOS and UNESCO World Heritage Center to reach out and say, because they'd already seen something had gone wrong, that the bulk of Africa, but particularly, was unaware of this convention. And they chose, somehow or other, got in touch with us, and got in touch with me in particular. And at that time, I had now left Greater Zimbabwe as now the deputy executive director for the whole National Museums and Monuments Network of Zimbabwe. And they identified Zimbabwe as the first port of call in the global strategy. So the first global strategy meeting in Africa was held in September, October, in Zimbabwe. And I played host to it, there were two parallel sessions, or they merged eventually, ICOMOS and the World Heritage Center aspect of it, World Heritage Committee part of it. So that's how, I must say, in fact, I'm not speaking just of Zimbabwe, I'm also speaking of the whole sub-region. That is the first time this notion came across. And I remember coming up in the process, leading some of the initiatives, and coming up with what we thought should be the components of World Heritage in this, you know, peculiarities and of our region. And we came up with what we thought were important categories of heritage to be included, and which had not yet been included, although the framework had come out from the 1994 Global Strategy, but we then had to put it in our context. So that's how I got to know what it was all about. And then from then, I really got very involved as a focal point in many respects, and as well as an expert on the area. So I became for 1995 and 1997, I was involved in the organization of the third global strategic meeting in held in Porto Novo, and then with the global strategy meeting that was held in Amsterdam, and another one on cultural landscapes in Africa, which was held in Tiwi, Kenya, and was involved in again in the redefining, you know, authenticity and integrity following the NARA model, and we came out with authenticity and integrity in an African context, you know. So from then, you know, it was then it was of course a great honor to have been elected to the World Heritage Committee in, I think it was 1997. Yes, it was 1997 session, and served the 6-year term, part of which 2000 in Keynes, I became the rapporteur of the World Heritage Committee. So, but you know, simultaneously, I got very interested in writing about our own experiences, and I've written quite substantially on this topic. My perspective about this convention in sub-Saharan Africa is that it has not been a success. Just like any other conventions that I've compared, the 1954 convention, 1997 convention, 1972 convention, and so on, and I'm looking at why are things not working out. The only convention that I think is working out is the 1992 convention on biodiversity in Africa.
How would you describe the key objectives of the convention?
Well, the key objectives, as I understand them, whether it's in practice or in theory, is that it seeks to link state parties to the international fora. In other words, it is a mechanism, one, that is hinged, obviously, on, as it says, protection. Protection of heritage of a special type, which would have been identified as of outstanding universal value, using different criteria that are outlined in the operational guidelines of the convention. But I think the centerpiece of it is the relationship between the state and the international community. And it is there that you find very interesting developments. And I've just been to this 34th conference, and you can really see the tensions between the state party and the international. What the expectations of state parties vis-a-vis the expectations of the global community is captured in the overall committee. Secondly, I think increasingly, I also can say that the convention is a lot in terms of building to bringing together, you know, a family spirit in which really you have, it's a forum in which we can all be at one in understanding general principles of that of the convention. That is the ideal. What I find a little bit difficult, however, is the fact that increasingly this common approach seems to be dissipating. We now have, I'm sorry to say, I know that it's a confidential thing, but I have no doubt that I don't mind it being said. The original intentions seem to be giving way more to the political dimensions. That which pushed us, most of us, to really look at the convention as a solution to many of our situations is increasingly moving away as we, for example, come to new systems, blocks, and so forth. That, and regrettably, I see this trend going, that seeming to marginalize the core issues that the convention should be looking at. And I find it regrettable because, you know, we are making serious efforts, for example, in the context of a progressive instrument or mechanism, which we came up with. And I was one of the chaps who was involved in coming up with a concept paper, the implementation of the World Heritage Convention in Africa, which was adopted by the World Heritage Committee in 2005. And was accepted by the Assembly of State Parties the same year, and took the unusual step of being accepted by the General Conference of UNESCO the same year. And for the first time ever, you had a convention that was endorsed, and this only one that was endorsed by the African Union head of state level in January 2006. And with it, you know, was the acceptance that one, the heritage, world heritage primarily belong to states, to state parties. But in this context that as African countries, we had something in common. So let's come up together and come up with a mechanism or a tool to ensure that the presence of the convention in Africa was real. And this position paper, which, as I said, was adopted by all those channels, identified the current weaknesses. Why is it things that were not going okay? And it's put to the fore the fact that state parties themselves had to bear the blame. And then it also looked at other partners in the World Heritage Committee, the advisory bodies, and private sector and partners. So, and then we then realized that one of the things that was a problem for Africa was the resource problem. And so attended to that, we said, okay, how can we address the issues arising from inadequacy of resources, awareness, and so forth? And that's when we came up with the idea of an Africa World Heritage Fund, of which you are the first patron. It's only African countries themselves that can take the lead in making the presence of and implementation of the convention in Africa a reality.
Let's talk about the World Heritage List. The list is very visible. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the originators of the convention had in mind, but we've just finished the 34th session in Brasilia, and there are now 911 sites on the World Heritage List. Some people say that's too many. Others say it's not enough. We know that there are a couple of thousand sites on tentative lists. Mm. Do you have a view about the size of the list? Do you think that's an important discussion?
Well, I would not bother about the numerical dimension of it. But increasingly, what is of concern is the fact that some of these are coming up under very contrived conditions. I do not, for one, believe that the issue of numbers is at the core, but the issue of outstanding universal values is at the core of it. If we go to the original tenets of what constitutes or what should be outstanding universal values, then I think the question of numbers will also be addressed. I've in my writings and also in my dissertation, I do agree that the definition of cultural and natural heritage as per the convention, it is flaws, there's no doubt, particularly in the way it emphasized on the tangible heritage and also heritage that is of initially of a monumentalistic. But I believe that in the case for Southern Africa, for example, the global strategy has done a lot of positive contributions. If you look at the sites that are being inscribed from Africa, most of them fall in the category of the global strategy. Cultural landscapes, cultural itineraries, spiritual sites, and the like. So if we go by that, then I see the positive dimension. But I, coming back to your question of numbers, I believe strict abidance by the principles of what it consists. I've seen at the 34th session, disappointed really, when what I believe the role of advisory bodies, which is to really advise the committee and to really filter and ensure that we meet certain minimum standards. And as you can see, this session, you know, it's just amendments coming from the floor, and those are then decided as the final thing. Yes, the World Aid Committee has powers, you know, it's a sovereign body. But I believe the question of numbers, the quality of nominations is are two interrelated issues. We need to really look at the quality of these nominations. But now I'll give you an example. I don't mention the name. There's a country which I am assisting to have a World Heritage site. That will be the first for that country, you know. And I was requested to assist this country. And so I said, now, for you people to understand exactly what it means, can you come to the 34th session? And so that you know what goes on. So when you do these things, it will help you. So yesterday, I said to one chap, I said, have you learned any lessons? Oh, yes. And what you know what he said? He said, it's all about lobbying. You see, I'm struggling to emphasize the importance of the quality of the nominations, and I've persuaded them not to hurry because it's a complex cultural landscape, but it will be the first of its type if we do the proper work. And they were saying, by 2011, it will be okay, we should be okay, and I'm saying 2011 is too soon. Let's do the proper work and we produce it in 2012. But what does he learn? He learns that, you know, through lobbying you can have it all the same.
Can you think of policy issues or individual cases, like sites, that have had a big influence on how the convention is implemented, kind of milestone cases or milestone policies that have changed a bit the way the convention is implemented?
One would look at the Yellowstone, you know, USA. I think that has also had a landmark.
What part about the Yellowstone?
Well, no, when I say the, in particular, when we're looking at the evolution of implementation of the World Heritage Convention with respect to sites on danger, uh-huh. I think that has had a major impact. I can also think of the Kakadu case of Australia, which has definitely brought in to the fore the issues of mining and the relationship with the site with regards to intangible heritage, for example, in the context of the convention. In my own personal experiences, I think is the inscription of Robben Island, South Africa, is really, it certainly made, you know, an impact with relation to criterion 6 of the operational guidelines. And in particular, I also say because subsequent to it, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, this criterion 6 has had a major. Most of the sites that have a component of spiritual heritage, which is now recognized. So I would say that would be a landmark, decision relating to the convention. So those are the ones that come to mind immediately.
Does the Nara case, or the opening up of the concept of authenticity through Nara, did that resonate in sub-Saharan?
Very much so. And to the extent that, as I said, we actually had a sub-Saharan submission, which was accepted by the World Heritage Committee, the authenticity and integrity in the context of Africa in year 2000. We had a conference at Great Zimbabwe.
Yes.
I played host to that one in Zimbabwe, in which we were looking at the Nara document and its applicability to the cultures of sub-Saharan Africa, and we came up with a series of recommendations. One of which was to say that whereas criterion 6 was strictly applicable in the context of other criteria, in the case of sub-Saharan Africa, there were cases where actually it could stand on its own without being attached to any other. And when it came to, it was a major debate when Robben Island was inscribed onto the World Heritage List. I did the evaluation of e-commerce evaluation of Robben Island, and I was totally convinced that it was a standalone in all dimensions. However, you know, because at that time, you know, the notion, following the other previous experiences of Hiroshima and so forth, the notion that it could be a standalone was still very much resisted. And I do know that we had to package something. But since then, of course, there has been some minor modifications to that. And this is why I say Robben Island is a case that, is important in the evolution of the implementation of the convention.
There's some kind of a big question, which is a wrap-up question, and you'll probably have different ways of looking at that. But basically, to take the step back and look at the World Heritage Convention and what you think are its successes and its failures, what are its strengths and how it's really done good things, and then where it is weak?
Yes, I have no doubt that statistically, in terms of state parties that have subscribed to it, 187 now, out of a possible 193, that is more than, it's nearly 100%. So in terms of ratification, it has been a major success. In terms of implementation, it's, again, the statistics speak for themselves. The fact that you have regions that are overrepresented, I don't want to say overrepresented, but this thing is a historical dimension. It's got a historical dimension. There was a time when we were totally unaware of the existence of this country, so we're trying to catch up. But notwithstanding this imbalance in terms of representation, on the World Heritage List is a bone of contention, which again I'll refer you to the auditor's report, external auditor's report. It's something that has to be addressed. Now, again, I like to refer to this report as well. It notes that one of the centerpieces of the World Heritage Convention was the introduction of the World Heritage Fund, which was an instrument or a mechanism to ensure that some of the problems that we're facing were addressed. But in terms, I think it's of Article 16.2 or so, where it says states are free to, at the time of their deposition or ratification, to say they will not be bound by the clauses of the World Heritage Fund, you know, relating to that. That is really the Achilles heel, as far as I'm concerned, in our relationship, particularly developing countries, in our relationship to the convention. Many developed countries have entered those relationships. Canada is not one of them, I must say.
Many developed countries,
Have entered reservations. Now, the result is that a central mechanism in the implementation of the convention, particularly in developing countries, has been taken away. Now, it is now observed, you see, by that external audit, that actually currently only 18% of the World Heritage Center resources is coming from the World Heritage Fund. And all these others are coming from extra budgetary resources, for which the committee by and large has no control, and that undermines the power of the committee, one. Two, it has brought about distortions in the fact that these funds coming from the developing countries have strings attached. You can only use them in their petty projects or in an area that they would like to be channeled, not necessarily according to the priorities of the committee. These extra budget resources are being used to take to bring staff from these countries to the detriment of, in other words, the staffing situation is now so lopsided in favor of those who are contributing from extra budgetary resources that you cannot have a fair geographical balance in the center, which is supposed to be administering the convention. A major strength, however, of what I would fairly say is the fact that at least efforts are underway to support through the Africa World Heritage Fund, for example, the inscription processes and conservation processes. And I think that's a way that helps to alleviate the situation arising from the dwindling World Heritage Fund's resource base. And maybe that's a plus, in the sense that at least the General Assembly of State Parties in UNESCO totally endorsed this this as a way forward. And so and there are ideas of having it in the Pacific as well and all that kind of thing. But you see, the bottom line is we're moving away from the fund. We're saying the fund...
Away from the World Heritage Fund.
Yeah, we're moving away to sub-funds. And this was never it's not in the convention at all.
No.
You see, so that's what I would sum it up is.
Was the Africa 2009 program of ICROM, led by ICROM, was that good for Africa?
It was. I must say... it was invariably most institutions have had people trained there. Those that have been trained, I believe it was quite particularly when it moved from Rome to come to Africa, to Mombasa. I think that's where it then began to have an impact. I think it's a program that has played its role. Regrettably, you see, training is an ongoing thing. You see, it should not have ever been envisaged that it's a cut and shut kind of scenario. Because, okay, with this folding up, so what? You see, there should have been contingency measures to take over from there.
So, just to wrap up, any final words on the convention?
Yes, the final word is please make it work. we should not pay lip service to this convention. the convention itself is quite clear and good. It's got its own faults, like I was saying, Article 16 negates this and so forth. But overall, and I must say, even the major weaknesses that it had, Articles 1 and 2 in defining natural heritage, those have been made, you know, have been improved markedly by the operational guidelines. So I think this mechanism of operational guidelines has really addressed major flaws of the convention. But it is up to state parties to make it work. It is up to state parties to really rededicate themselves to understanding this convention. Mm-hmm. And the implementing guidelines, and to be committed to it, in the because it's a global convention. If we put the global international community and work as a family for which it was envisaged, that what happens to country so and so affects everyone. Let's collectively come together, and that way we will have the necessary critical mass. If we go back to that spirit, then it will work. But if we go back to what is increasingly happening, that the center, the state party is so concerned about itself, doesn't care what is happening elsewhere, and they want to push their case, to the detriment of the international community, then that's where we have a problem. The third point is that it needs to be at state level. It needs to permeate the local communities.